creating ichor, the golden blood of the gods.
You heard the boy, said the man in the shadows. Decide.
Artemis's eyes flashed with anger. I didn't know why she just didn't will the chains to burst or make herself disappear, but she didn't seem able to. Maybe the chains prevented her, or some magic about this dark, horrible place. The goddess looked at Annabeth, and her expression changed to concern and outrage. How dare you torture a maiden like this?
She will die soon, Luke said. You can save her.
Annabeth made a weak sound of protest. My heart felt like it was being twisted into a knot. I wanted to run to her, but I couldn't move.
Free my hands, Artemis said.
Luke brought out his sword, Backbiter. With one expert strike, he broke the goddess's handcuffs. Artemis ran to Annabeth and took the burden from her shoulders. Annabeth collapsed on the ground and lay there shivering. Artemis staggered, trying to support the weight of the black rocks. The man in the shadows chuckled.
Ho, ho, ho. You are as predictable as you were easy to beat, Artemis.
You surprised me,
the goddess said, straining under her burden.
It will not happen again.
Indeed it will not, the man said. Now you are out of the way for good. I knew you could not resist helping a young maiden. That is, after all, your specialty, my dear.
Artemis groaned.
You know nothing of mercy, you swine.
On that, the man said, we can agree. Luke, you may kill the girl now.
No,
Artemis shouted. Luke hesitated.
She may yet be useful, sir. Further bait. Bah! You truly believe that?
Yes, General. They will come for her, I'm sure.
The man considered.
Then the Dracaena can guard her here. Assuming she does not die from her injuries, you may keep her alive until winter solstice. After that, if our sacrifice goes as planned, her life will be meaningless. The lives of all mortals will be meaningless.
Luke gathered up Annabeth's listless body and carried her away from the goddess.
You will never find the monster you seek, Artemis said. Your plan will fail.
How little you know, my young goddess,
the man in the shadows said.
Even now, your darling attendants begin their quest to find you. They shall play directly into my hands. Now, if you'll excuse us, we have a long journey to make. We must greet your hunters and make sure their quest is challenging.
The man's laughter echoed in the darkness, shaking the ground until it seemed the whole cavern ceiling would collapse. I woke with a start. I was sure I'd heard a loud banging. I looked around the cabin. It was dark outside. The salt spring still gurgled. No other sounds but the hoot of an owl in the woods and the distant surf on the beach. In the moonlight, on my nightstand, was Annabeth's New York Yankees cap. I stared at it for a second, and then... bang! Bang! Someone or something was pounding on my door. I grabbed Riptide and got out of bed. Hello? I called. Thump! Thump! I crept to the door. I uncapped the blade, flung open the door, and found myself face to face with a black Pegasus.
Whoa, boss!
Its voice spoke in my mind as it clopped away from the sword blade.
I don't want to be a horse kebab!
Its black wings spread in alarm, and the wind buffeted me back a step. Blackjack! I said, relieved but a little irritated. It's the middle of the night. Blackjack huffed.
Ain't either, boss. It's 5 in the morning. What are you still sleeping for?
How many times have I told you, don't call me boss?
Whatever you say, boss. You're the man. You're my number one.
I rubbed the sleep out of my eyes and tried not to let the Pegasus read my thoughts. That's the problem with being Poseidon's son. Since he created horses out of sea foam, I can understand most equestrian animals, but they can understand me too. Sometimes, like in Blackjack's case, they kind of adopt me. See, Blackjack had been a captive on board Luke's ship last summer, until we'd caused a little distraction that allowed him to escape. I'd really had very little to do with it, seriously, but Blackjack credited me with saving him. Blackjack, I said, you're supposed to stay in the stables.
The stables! You see Chiron staying in the stables?
Well, no.
Exactly! Listen, we got another little sea friend needs your help.
Again?
Yeah, I told the hippocampi I'd come get you.
I groaned. Anytime I was anywhere near the beach, the hippocampi would ask me to help them with their problems. And they had a lot of problems. Beached whales, porpoises caught in fishing nets, mermaids with hangnails. They'd call me to come underwater and help. All right, I said. I'm coming.
You're the best, boss!
And don't call me boss. Blackjack whinnied softly. It might have been a laugh. I looked back at my comfortable bed. My bronze shield still hung on the wall, dented and unusable. And on my nightstand was Annabeth's magic Yankees cap. On an impulse, I stuck the cap in my pocket. I guess I had a feeling, even then, that I wasn't coming back to my cabin for a long, long time. Chapter 8. I Make a Dangerous Promise. Blackjack gave me a ride down the beach, and I have to admit it was cool, being on a flying horse, skimming over the waves at 100 miles an hour with the wind in my hair and the sea spray in my face. Hey, it beats water skiing any day.
Here!
Blackjack slowed and turned in a circle, straight down. Thanks. I tumbled off his back and plunged into the icy sea. I'd gotten more comfortable doing stunts like that the past couple of years. I could pretty much move however I wanted to underwater, just by willing the ocean currents to change around me and propel me along. I could breathe underwater, no problem, and my clothes never got wet unless I wanted them to. I shot down into the darkness, 20, 30, 40 feet. The pressure wasn't uncomfortable. I'd never tried to push it, to see if there was a limit to how deep I could dive. I knew most regular humans couldn't go past 200 feet without crumpling like an aluminum can. I should have been blind, too, this deep in the water at night, but I could see the heat from living forms and the cold of the currents. It's hard to describe. It wasn't like regular seeing, but I could tell where everything was. As I got closer to the bottom, I saw 3 hippocampi, fish-tailed horses, swimming in a circle around an overturned boat. The hippocampi were beautiful to watch. Their fish tails shimmered in rainbow colors, glowing phosphorescent. Their manes were white, and they were galloping through the water the way nervous horses do in a thunderstorm. Something was upsetting them. I got closer and saw the problem. A dark shape, some kind of animal, was wedged halfway under the boat and tangled in a fishing net. One of those big nets they use on trawlers to catch everything at once. I hated those things. It was bad enough they drowned porpoises and dolphins, but they also occasionally caught mythological animals. When the nets got tangled, some lazy fisherman would just cut them loose and let the trapped animals die. Apparently, this poor creature had been mucking around on the bottom of Long Island Sound and had somehow gotten itself tangled in the net of this sunken fishing boat. It had tried to get out and managed to get even more hopelessly stuck, shifting the boat in the process. Now the wreckage of the hull, which was resting against a big rock, was teetering and threatening to collapse on top of the tangled animal. The hippocampi were swimming around frantically, wanting to help but not sure how. One was trying to chew the net, but hippocampi teeth just aren't meant for cutting rope. Hippocampi are really strong, but they don't have hands, and they're not, shh, all that smart.
"Free it, Lord,"
a hippocampus said when it saw me. The others joined in, asking the same thing. I swam in for a closer look at the tangled creature. At first, I thought it was a young hippocampus. I'd rescued several of them before, but then I heard a strange sound, something that did not belong underwater.
Moo!
I got next to the thing and saw that it was a cow. I mean, I'd heard of sea cows, like manatees and stuff, but this really was a cow, with the back end of a serpent. The front half was a calf, a baby, with black fur and big sad brown eyes and a white muzzle, and its back half was a black and brown snaky tail with fins running down the top and bottom like an enormous eel. "Whoa, little one," I said. "Where did you come from?" The creature looked at me sadly.
"Moo."
But I couldn't understand its thoughts. I only speak hoarse.
"We don't know what it is, Lord,"
one of the hippocampi said.
"Many strange things are stirring."
"Yeah," I murmured. "So I've heard." I uncapped Riptide, and the sword grew to full length in my hands, its bronze blade gleaming in the dark. The cow serpent freaked out and started struggling against the net, its eyes full of terror. "Whoa," I said. "I'm not going to hurt you. Just let me cut the net." But the cow serpent thrashed around and got even more tangled. The boat started to tilt, stirring up the muck on the sea bottom and threatening to topple onto the cow serpent. The hippocampi whinnied in a panic and thrashed in the water, which didn't help. "Okay, okay," I said. I put away the sword and started speaking as calmly as I could so the hippocampi and the cow serpent would stop panicking. I didn't know if it was possible to get stampeded underwater, but I didn't really want to find out. "It's cool. No sword. See? No sword. Calm thoughts. Seagrass. Mama cows. Vegetarianism." I doubted the cow serpent understood what I was saying, but it responded to the tone of my voice. The hippocampi were still skittish, but they stopped swirling around me quite so fast.
"Free it, Lord,"
they pleaded. "Yeah," I said. "I got that part. I'm thinking." But how could I free the cow serpent when she, I decided it was probably a she, panicked at the sight of a blade? It was like she'd seen swords before and knew how dangerous they were. "All right," I told the hippocampi. "I need all of you to push exactly the way I tell you." First, we started with the boat. It wasn't easy, but with the strength of 3 horsepower, we managed to shift the wreckage so it was no longer threatening to collapse on the baby cow serpent. Then I went to work on the net, untangling it section by section, getting lead weights and fishing hooks straightened out, yanking out knots around the cow serpent's hooves. It took forever. I mean, it was worse than the time I had to untangle all my video game controller wires. The whole time, I kept talking to the cowfish, telling her everything was okay while she mooed and moaned. "It's okay, Bessie," I said. Don't ask me why I started calling her that. It just seemed like a good cow name. "Good cow. Nice cow." Finally, the net came off and the cow serpent zipped through the water and did a happy somersault. The hippocampi whinnied with joy.
"Thank you, Lord." "Moo."
The cow serpent nuzzled me and gave me the big brown eyes. "Yeah," I said.
That's okay. Nice cow. Well, stay out of trouble.
Which reminded me, I'd been underwater how long? An hour, at least. I had to get back to my cabin before Argus of the Harpies discovered I was breaking curfew. I shot to the surface and broke through. Immediately, Blackjack zoomed down and let me catch a hold of his neck. He lifted me into the air and took me back toward the shore.
Success, boss?
Yeah, we rescued a baby... something or other. Took forever. Almost got stampeded.
Good deeds are always dangerous, boss. You saved my sorry mane, didn't you?
I couldn't help thinking about my dream, with Annabeth crumpled and lifeless in Luke's arms. Here I was rescuing baby monsters, but I couldn't save my friend. As Blackjack flew back toward my cabin, I happened to glance at the dining pavilion. I saw a figure, a boy hunkered down behind a Greek column, like he was hiding from someone. It was Nico, but it wasn't even dawn yet. Nowhere near time for breakfast. What was he doing up there? I hesitated. The last thing I wanted was more time for Nico to tell me about his Myth-O-Magic game. But something was wrong. I could tell by the way he was crouching.
Blackjack, I said. Set me down over there, will you? Behind that column.
I almost blew it. I was coming up the steps behind Nico. He didn't see me at all. He was behind a column, peeking around the corner, all his attention focused on the dining area. I was 5 feet away from him, and I was about to say, "What are you doing?" real loud, when it occurred to me that he was pulling a Grover. He was spying on the hunters. There were voices, two girls talking at one of the dining tables. At this ungodly hour of the morning? Well, unless you're the goddess of dawn, I guess. I took Annabeth's magic cap out of my pocket and put it on. I didn't feel any different, but when I raised my arms, I couldn't see them. I was invisible. I crept up to Nico and sneaked around him. I couldn't see the girls very well in the dark, but I knew their voices, Zoe and Bianca. It sounded like they were arguing.
"It cannot be cured," Zoe was saying, "not quickly, at any rate."
"But how did it happen?" Bianca asked.
"A foolish prank," Zoe growled. "Those stall boys from the Hermes cabin. Centaur blood is like acid. Everyone knows that. They sprayed the inside of that Artemis hunting tour t-shirt with it."
"That's terrible."
"She will live," Zoe said. "But she'll be bedridden for weeks with horrible hives. There is no way she can go. It's up to me and thee."
"But the prophecy," Bianca said. "If Phoebe can't go, we only have four. We'll have to pick another."
"There is no time," Zoe said. "We must leave at first light. That's immediately. Besides, the prophecy said we would lose one."
"In the land without rain," Bianca said. "But that can't be here."
"It might be," Zoe said, though she didn't sound convinced. "The camp has magic borders. Nothing, not even weather, is allowed in without permission. It could be a land without rain."
"But, Bianca, hear me."
Zoe's voice was strained.
I can't explain, but I have a sense that we should not pick someone else. It would be too dangerous. They would meet an end worse than Phoebe's. I don't want Chiron choosing a camper as our fifth companion. And I don't want to risk another hunter."
Bianca was silent.
"You should tell Thalia the rest of your dream."
"No, it would not help."
"But if your suspicions are correct about the general..."
"I have thy word not to talk about that," Zoe said. She sounded really anguished. "We will find out soon enough. Now come, dawn is breaking."
Nico scooted out of their way. He was faster than me. As the girls sprinted down the steps, Zoe almost ran into me. She froze, her eyes narrowing,
Her hand crept toward her bow, but then Bianca said, "The lights of the big house are on! Hurry!" And Zoe followed her out of the pavilion. I could tell what Nico was thinking. He took a deep breath and was about to run after his sister when I took off the invisibility cap and said, "Wait." He almost slipped on the icy steps as he spun around to find me.
"Where did you come from?"
"I've been here the whole time, invisible." He mouthed the word, "invisible."
"Wow, cool."
"How did you know Zoe and your sister were here?" He blushed. "I heard them walk by the Hermes cabin. I don't sleep too well at camp. So I heard footsteps and them whispering, and so I kind of followed."
"And now you're thinking about following them on the quest," I guessed.
"How did you know that?"
"Because if it was my sister, I'd probably be thinking the same thing. But you can't."
He looked defiant. "Because I'm too young?"
"Because they won't let you. They'll catch you and send you back here. And, yeah, because you're too young. You remember the manticore? There'll be lots more like that, more dangerous. Some of the heroes will die."
His shoulders sagged. He shifted from foot to foot. "Maybe you're right, but you can go for me."
"Say what?"
"You can turn invisible. You can go."
"The hunters don't like boys," I reminded him. "If they find out..."
"Don't let them find out. Follow them invisibly. Keep an eye on my sister. You have to. Please."
"Nico,
you're planning to go anyway, aren't you?"
I wanted to say no, but he looked me in the eyes, and I somehow couldn't lie to him.
"Yeah," I said. "I have to find Annabeth. I have to help, even if they don't want me to."
"I won't tell on you," he said, "but you have to promise to keep my sister safe."
That's a big thing to promise, Nico, on a trip like this. Besides, she's got Zoe, Grover, and Thalia.
"Promise," he insisted.
"I'll do my best, I promise that."
"Get going then," he said. "Good luck."
It was crazy. I wasn't packed. I had nothing but the cap and the sword and the clothes I was wearing. I was supposed to be going home to Manhattan this morning.
"Tell Chiron."
"I'll make something up," Nico smiled crookedly. "I'm good at that. Go on." I ran, putting on Annabeth's cap. As the sun came up, I turned invisible. I hit the top of Half-Blood Hill in time to see the camp's van disappearing down the farm road, probably Argus taking the quest group into the city. After that, they would be on their own. I felt a twinge of guilt and stupidity, too. How was I supposed to keep up with them? Run? Then I heard the beating of huge wings. Blackjack landed next to me. He began casually nuzzling a few tufts of grass that stuck through the ice.
"If I was guessing, boss, I'd say you need a getaway horse. You interested?"
A lump of gratitude stuck in my throat, but I managed to say, "Yeah, let's fly." Chapter 9. I Learn How to Grow Zombies. The thing about flying on a Pegasus during the daytime is that if you're not careful, you can cause a serious traffic accident on the Long Island Expressway. I had to keep Blackjack up in the clouds, which were fortunately pretty low in the winter. We darted around, trying to keep the white Camp Half-Blood van in sight. And if it was cold on the ground, it was seriously cold in the air, with icy rain stinging my skin. I was wishing I'd brought some of that Camp Half-Blood orange thermal underwear they sold in the camp store, but after the story about Phoebe and the Centaur Blood t-shirt, I wasn't sure I trusted their products anymore. We lost the van twice, but I had a pretty good sense that they would go into Manhattan first, so it wasn't too difficult to pick up their trail again. Traffic was bad with the holidays and all. It was mid-morning before they got into the city. I landed Blackjack near the top of the Chrysler building and watched the white camp van, thinking it would pull into the bus station, but it just kept driving. "Where's Argus taking them?" I muttered.
"Oh, Argus ain't driving, boss," Blackjack told me. "That girl is."
"Which girl?"
"The hunter girl, with the silver crown thing in her hair."
"Zoe?"
"That's the one. Hey, look, there's a donut shop. Can we get something to go?"
I tried explaining to Blackjack that taking a flying horse to a donut shop would give every cop in there a heart attack, but he didn't seem to get it. Meanwhile, the van kept snaking its way toward the Lincoln Tunnel. It had never even occurred to me that Zoe could drive. I mean, she didn't look 16. Then again, she was immortal. I wondered if she had a New York license, and if so, what her birth date said. "Well," I said, "let's get after them." We were about to leap off the Chrysler building when Blackjack whinnied in alarm and almost threw me. Something was curling around my leg like a snake. I reached for my sword, but when I looked down, there was no snake. Vines, grapevines, had sprouted from the cracks between the stones of the building. They were wrapping around Blackjack's legs, lashing down my ankles so we couldn't move.
"Going somewhere?" Mr. D asked.
He was leaning against the building with his feet levitating in the air, his leopard skin warm-up suit and black hair whipping around in the wind.
"God alert!" Blackjack yelled. "It's the wine dude!"
Mr. D sighed in exasperation.
"The next person or horse who calls me the wine dude will end up in a bottle of Merlot."
"Mr. D?" I tried to keep my voice calm as the grapevines continued to wrap around my legs. "What do you want?"
"Oh, what do I want? You thought perhaps that the immortal, all-powerful director of camp would not notice you leaving without permission?"
"Well, maybe."
"I should throw you off this building, minus the flying horse, and see how heroic you sound on the way down."
I balled my fists. I knew I should keep my mouth shut, but Mr. D was about to kill me or haul me back to camp in shame, and I couldn't stand either idea. "Why do you hate me so much? What did I ever do to you?" Purple flames flickered in his eyes.
"You're a hero, boy. I need no other reason."
"I have to go on this quest. I've got to help my friends. That's something you wouldn't understand."
Boss? Blackjack said nervously. "Seeing as how we're wrapped in vines 900 feet in the air, you might want to talk nice."
The grapevines coiled tighter around me. Below us, the white van was getting farther and farther away. Soon it would be out of sight.
"Did I ever tell you about Ariadne?"
Mr. D asked.
"Beautiful young princess of Crete. She liked helping her friends, too. In fact, she helped a young hero named Theseus, also a son of Poseidon. She gave him a ball of magical yarn that let him find his way out of the labyrinth. And do you know how Theseus rewarded her?"
The answer I wanted to give was, "I don't care." But I didn't figure that would make Mr. D finish his story any faster. "They got married," I said, "happily ever after. The end." Mr. D sneered.
"Not quite. Theseus said he would marry her. He took her aboard his ship and sailed for Athens. Halfway back, on a little island called Naxos, he... what's the word you mortals use today? He dumped her. I found her there, you know, alone, heartbroken, crying her eyes out. She had given up everything, left everything she knew behind, to help a dashing young hero who tossed her away like a broken sandal."
"That's wrong," I said, "but that was thousands of years ago. What's that got to do with me?"
Mr. D regarded me coldly.
I fell in love with Ariadne, boy. I healed her broken heart, and when she died, I made her my immortal wife in Olympus. She waits for me even now. I shall go back to her when I'm done with this infernal century of punishment at your ridiculous camp.
I stared at him. You're married? But I thought you got in trouble for chasing a wood nymph.
My point is you heroes never change. You accuse us gods of being vain. You should look at yourselves. You take what you want, use whoever you have to, and then you betray everyone around you. So you'll excuse me if I have no love for heroes. They are a selfish, ungrateful lot. Ask Ariadne, or Medea. For that matter, ask Zoe Nightshade.
What do you mean, ask Zoe? He waved his hand dismissively.
Go, follow your silly friends.
The vines uncurled around my legs. I blinked in disbelief. You're letting me go? Just like that?
The prophecy says at least two of you will die. Perhaps I'll get lucky and you'll be one of them. But mark my words, son of Poseidon, live or die, you will prove no better than the other heroes.
With that, Dionysus snapped his fingers. His image folded up like a paper display. There was a pop, and he was gone, leaving a faint scent of grapes that was quickly blown away by the wind.
Too close, Blackjack said.
I nodded, though I almost would have been less worried if Mr. D had hauled me back to camp. The fact that he let me go meant he really believed we stood a fair chance of crashing and burning on this quest. Come on, Blackjack, I said, trying to sound upbeat. I'll buy you some donuts in New Jersey. As it turned out, I didn't buy Blackjack donuts in New Jersey. Zoe drove south like a crazy person, and we were into Maryland before she finally pulled over at a rest stop. Blackjack darn near tumbled out of the sky. He was so tired.
I'll be okay, boss, he panted. Just catching my breath.
Stay here, I told him. I'm going to scout.
Stay here, I can handle. I can do that.
I put on my cap of invisibility and walked over to the convenience store. It was difficult not to sneak. I had to keep reminding myself that nobody could see me. It was hard, too, because I had to remember to get out of people's way so they wouldn't slam into me. I thought I'd go inside and warm up, maybe get a cup of hot chocolate or something. I had a little change in my pocket. I could leave it on the counter. I was wondering if the cup would turn invisible when I picked it up, or if I'd have to deal with a floating hot chocolate problem when my whole plan was ruined by Zoe, Thalia, Bianca, and Grover, all coming out of the store.
Grover, are you sure? Thalia was saying. Well, pretty sure. 99%. Okay, 85%.
And you did this with acorns? Bianca asked, like she couldn't believe it.
Grover looked offended.
It's a time-honored tracking spell. I mean, I'm pretty sure I did it right.
DC is about 60 miles from here, Bianca said. Nico and I...
She frowned.
We used to live there. That's strange. I'd forgotten.
I dislike this, Zoe said. We should go straight west. The prophecy said west.
Oh, like your tracking skills are better? Thalia growled.
Zoe stepped toward her.
You challenge my skills, you scullion. You know nothing of being a hunter.
Oh, scullion? You're calling me a scullion? What the heck is a scullion?
Whoa, you two, Grover said nervously. Come on, not again.
Grover's right, Bianca said. DC is our best bet.
Zoe didn't look convinced, but she nodded reluctantly.
Very well, let us keep moving.
You're going to get us arrested driving, Thalia grumbled. I look closer to 16 than you do.
Perhaps, Zoe snapped. But I have been driving since automobiles were invented. Let us go.
As Blackjack and I continued south, following the van, I wondered whether Zoe had been kidding. I didn't know exactly when cars were invented, but I figured that was like prehistoric times, back when people watched black and white TV and hunted dinosaurs. How old was Zoe? And what had Mr. D been talking about? What bad experience had she had with heroes? As we got closer to Washington, Blackjack started slowing down and dropping altitude. He was breathing heavily.
"You okay?" I asked him.
"Fine, boss. I could take on an army."
"You don't sound so good." And suddenly, I felt guilty, because I'd been running the Pegasus for half a day, nonstop, trying to keep up with highway traffic. Even for a flying horse, that had to be rough.
"Don't worry about me, boss. I'm a tough one."
I figured he was right, but I also figured Blackjack would run himself into the ground before he complained, and I didn't want that. Fortunately, the van started to slow down. It crossed the Potomac River into central Washington. I started thinking about air patrols and missiles and stuff like that. I didn't know exactly how all those defenses worked, and wasn't sure if Pegasi even showed up on your typical military radar, but I didn't want to find out by getting shot out of the sky. "Set me down there," I told Blackjack. "That's close enough." Blackjack was so tired he didn't complain. He dropped toward the Washington Monument and set me on the grass. The van was only a few blocks away. Zoe had parked at the curb. I looked at Blackjack. "I want you to go back to camp. Get some rest. Graze. I'll be fine." Blackjack cocked his head skeptically.
"You sure, boss?"
"You've done enough already," I said. "I'll be fine. And thanks a ton."
"A ton of hay, maybe," Blackjack mused. "That sounds good. All right, but be careful, boss. I got a feeling they didn't come here to meet anything friendly and handsome like me."
I promised to be careful. Then Blackjack took off, circling twice around the monument before disappearing into the clouds. I looked over at the white van. Everybody was getting out. Grover pointed toward one of the big buildings lining the mall. Thalia nodded, and the four of them trudged off into the cold wind. I started to follow, but then I froze. A block away, the door of a black sedan opened. A man with gray hair and a military buzz cut got out. He was wearing dark shades and a black overcoat. Now, maybe in Washington, you'd expect guys like that to be everywhere. But it dawned on me that I'd seen this same car a couple of times on the highway, going south. It had been following the van. The guy took out his mobile phone and said something into it. Then he looked around, like he was making sure the coast was clear, and started walking down the mall in the direction of my friends. The worst of it was, when he turned toward me, I recognized his face. It was Dr. Thorne, the Manticore from Westover Hall. Invisibility cap on, I followed Thorne from a distance. My heart was pounding. If he had survived that fall from the cliff, then Annabeth must have too. My dreams had been right. She was alive and being held prisoner. Thorne kept well back from my friends, careful not to be seen. Finally, Grover stopped in front of a big building that said National Air and Space Museum, the Smithsonian. I'd been here a million years ago with my mom, but everything had looked so much bigger then. Thalia checked the door. It was open, but there weren't many people going in. Too cold, and school was out of session. They slipped inside. Dr. Thorne hesitated. I wasn't sure why, but he didn't go into the museum. He turned and headed across the mall. I made a split-second decision and followed him. Thorne crossed the street and climbed the steps of the Museum of Natural History. There was a big sign on the door. At first I thought it said,
closed for pirate event, then I realized pirate must be private. I followed Dr. Thorne inside, through a huge chamber full of mastodons and dinosaur skeletons. There were voices up ahead, coming from behind a set of closed doors. Two guards stood outside. They opened the doors for Thorne, and I had to sprint to get inside before they closed them again. Inside, what I saw was so terrible I almost gasped out loud, which probably would have gotten me killed. I was in a huge round room with a balcony ringing the second level. At least a dozen mortal guards stood on the balcony, plus two monsters, reptilian women with double snake trunks instead of legs. I'd seen them before. Annabeth had called them Scythian Dracaena. But that wasn't the worst of it. Standing between the snake women, I could swear he was looking straight down at me, was my old enemy Luke. He looked terrible. His skin was pale, and his blonde hair looked almost gray, as if he'd aged 10 years in just a few months. The angry light in his eyes was still there, and so was the scar down the side of his face, where a dragon had once scratched him. But the scar was now ugly red, as though it had recently been reopened. Next to him, sitting down so that the shadows covered him, was another man. All I could see were his knuckles on the gilded arms of the chair, like a throne.
"Well?"
asked the man in the chair. His voice was just like the one I'd heard in my dream, not as creepy as Kronos's, but deeper and stronger, like the earth itself was talking. It filled the whole room, even though he wasn't yelling. Dr. Thorne took off his shades. His two-colored eyes, brown and blue, glittered with excitement. He made a stiff bow, then spoke in his weird French accent.
"They are here, General." "I know that, you fool," boomed the man. "But where?" "In the Rocket Museum." "The Air and Space Museum," Luke corrected irritably.
Dr. Thorne glared at Luke.
"As you say, sir."
I got the feeling Thorne would just as soon impale Luke with one of his spikes as call him sir.
"How many?" Luke asked.
Thorne pretended not to hear.
"How many?"
the general demanded.
4, General," Thorne said. "The satyr, Grover Underwood, and the girl with the spiky black hair, and the, how do you say, punk clothes, and the horrible shield." "Thalia," Luke said. "And 2 other girls, hunters. One wears a silver circlet." "That one I know," the general growled.
Everyone in the room shifted uncomfortably.
"Let me take them," Luke said to the general. "We have more than enough..." "Patience," the general said. "They'll have their hands full already. I've sent a little playmate to keep them occupied. But we cannot risk you, my boy." "Yes, boy," Dr. Thorne said with a cruel smile. "You are much too fragile to risk. Let me finish them off." "No."
The general rose from his chair, and I got my first look at him. He was tall and muscular, with light brown skin and slick back dark hair. He wore an expensive brown silk suit like the guys on Wall Street wear, but you'd never mistake this dude for a broker. He had a brutal face, huge shoulders, and hands that could snap a flagpole in half. His eyes were like stone. I felt as if I were looking at a living statue. It was amazing he could even move.
"You have already failed me, Thorne," he said. "But, General, no excuses."
Thorne flinched. I thought Thorne was scary when I first saw him in his black uniform at the military academy. But now, standing before the general, Thorne looked like a silly wannabe soldier. The general was the real deal. He didn't need a uniform. He was a born commander.
I should throw you into the pits of Tartarus for your incompetence, the general said. I send you to capture a child of the three elder gods, and you bring me a scrawny daughter of Athena. But you promised me revenge, Thorne protested. A command of my own. I am Lord Kronos' senior commander, the general said, and I will choose lieutenants who get me results. It was only thanks to Luke that we salvaged our plan at all. Now get out of my sight, Thorne, until I find some other menial task for you.
Thorne's face turned purple with rage. I thought he was going to start frothing at the mouth or shooting spines, but he just bowed awkwardly and left the room.
Now, my boy,
the general turned to Luke.
The first thing we must do is isolate the half-blood Thalia. The monster we seek will then come to her. The hunters will be difficult to dispose of, Luke said. Zoe Nightshade, do not speak her name.
Luke swallowed.
Sorry, General, I just...
The general silenced him with a wave of his hand.
Let me show you, my boy, how we will bring the hunters down.
He pointed to a guard on the ground level.
Do you have the teeth?
The guy stumbled forward with a ceramic pot.
Yes, General.
Plant them, he said.
In the center of the room was a big circle of dirt, where I guess a dinosaur exhibit was supposed to go. I watched nervously as the guard took sharp white teeth out of the pot and pushed them into the soil. He smoothed them over while the general smiled coldly. The guard stepped back from the dirt and wiped his hands.
Ready, General.
Excellent. Water them, and we will let them scent their prey.
The guard picked up a little tin watering can with daisies painted on it, which was kind of bizarre, because what he poured out wasn't water. It was dark red liquid, and I got the feeling it wasn't Hawaiian punch. The soil began to bubble.
Soon, the general said, I will show you, Luke, soldiers that will make your army from that little boat look insignificant.
Luke clenched his fists.
I've spent a year training my forces. When the Princess Andromeda arrives at the mountain, they'll be the best... Huh, the general said. I don't deny your troops will make a fine honor guard for Lord Kronos, and you, of course, will have a role to play.
I thought Luke turned paler when the general said that.
But under my leadership, the forces of Lord Kronos will increase 100-fold. We will be unstoppable. Behold, my ultimate killing machines.
The soil erupted. I stepped back nervously. In each spot where a tooth had been planted, a creature was struggling out of the dirt. The first of them said,
Mew?
It was a kitten, a little orange tabby with stripes like a tiger. Then another appeared, until there were a dozen, rolling around and playing in the dirt. Everyone stared at them in disbelief. The general roared,
What is this? Cute, cuddly kittens? Where did you find those teeth?
The guard who'd brought the teeth cowered in fear.
From the exhibit, sir. Just like you said, the saber-toothed tiger.
No, you idiot. I said the Tyrannosaurus. Gather up those infernal fuzzy little beasts and take them outside, and never let me see your face again.
The terrified guard dropped his watering can. He gathered up the kittens and scampered out of the room.
You!
The general pointed to another guard.
Get me the right teeth, now!
The new guard ran off to carry out his orders.
Imbeciles,
muttered the general.
This is why I don't use mortals, Luke said. They are unreliable. They are weak-minded, easily bought, and violent. The general said. I love them.
A minute later, the guard hustled into the room with his hands full of large pointy teeth.
Excellent,
the general said. He climbed onto the balcony railing and jumped down 20 feet. Where he landed, the marble floor cracked under his leather shoes. He stood, wincing, and rubbed his shoulders.
Curse my stiff neck.
Another hot pad, sir?
A guard asked.
More Tylenol?
No, it will pass.
The general brushed off his silk suit, then snatched up the teeth.
I shall do this myself.
He held up one of the teeth and smiled.
Dinosaur teeth, huh? Those foolish mortals don't even know when they have dragon teeth in their possession. And not just any dragon teeth. These come from the ancient Sybaris herself. They shall do nicely.
He planted them in the dirt, 12 in all. Then he scooped up the watering can. He sprinkled the soil with red liquid, tossed the can away, and held his arms out wide.
Rise!
The dirt trembled. A single skeletal hand shot out of the ground, grasping at the air. The general looked up at the balcony.
Quickly, do you have the scent?
Yes, Lord,
one of the snake ladies said. She took out a sash of silvery fabric, like the kind the hunters wore.
Excellent, the general said. Once my warriors catch its scent, they will pursue its owner relentlessly. Nothing can stop them, no weapons known to half-blood or hunter. They will tear the hunters and their allies to shreds. Toss it here.
As he said that, skeletons erupted from the ground. There were 12 of them, one for each tooth the general had planted. They were nothing like Halloween skeletons or the kind you might see in cheesy movies. These were growing flesh as I watched, turning into men, but men with dull gray skin, yellow eyes, and modern clothes, gray muscle shirts, camel pants, and combat boots. If you didn't look too closely, you could almost believe they were human, but their flesh was transparent, and their bones shimmered underneath, like X-ray images. One of them looked straight at me, regarding me coldly, and I knew that no cap of invisibility would fool it. The snake lady released the scarf, and it fluttered down toward the general's hand. As soon as he gave it to the warriors, they would hunt Zoe and the other hunters until they were extinct. I didn't have time to think. I ran and jumped with all my might, plowing into the warriors and snatching the scarf out of the air.
What's this?
Bellowed the general. I landed at the feet of a skeleton warrior who hissed.
An intruder, the general growled. One cloaked in darkness. Seal the doors. It's Percy Jackson, Luke yelled. It has to be.
I sprinted for the exit, but heard a ripping sound and realized the skeleton warrior had taken a chunk out of my sleeve. When I glanced back, he was holding the fabric up to his nose, sniffing the scent, handing it around to his friends. I wanted to scream, but I couldn't. I squeezed through the door just as the guard slammed it shut behind me, and then I ran. Chapter 10. I Break a Few Rocket Ships. I tore across the mall, not daring to look behind me. I burst into the Air and Space Museum and took off my invisibility cap once I was through the admissions area. The main part of the museum was one huge room with rockets and airplanes hanging from the ceiling. 3 levels of balconies curled around, so you could look at the exhibits from all different heights. The place wasn't crowded, just a few families and a couple of tour groups of kids, probably doing one of those holiday school trips. I wanted to yell at them all to leave, but I figured that would only get me arrested. I had to find Thalia and Grover and the hunters. Any minute, the skeleton dudes were going to invade the museum, and I didn't think they would settle for an audio tour. I ran into Thalia. Literally. I was barreling up the ramp to the top-floor balcony and slammed into her, knocking her into an Apollo space capsule. Grover yelped in surprise. Before I could regain my balance, Zoe and Bianca had arrows notched, aimed at my chest. Their bows had just appeared out of nowhere. When Zoe realized who I was, she didn't seem anxious to lower her bow.
"You! How dare you show thy face here!"
"Percy," Grover said. "Thank goodness."
Zoe glared at him, and he blushed.
"I mean, gosh, you're not supposed to be here."
"Luke," I said, trying to catch my breath. "He's here." The anger in Thalia's eyes immediately melted. She put her hand on her silver bracelet.
"Where?"
I told them about the Natural History Museum. Dr. Thorne, Luke, and the General.
"The General is here."
Zoe looked stunned.
"That is impossible. You lie."
"Why would I lie? Look, there's no time. Skeleton warriors."
"What?"
Thalia demanded. "How many?" 12, I said, "and that's not all. That guy, the General, he said he was sending something, a playmate, to distract you over here. A monster." Thalia and Grover exchanged looks.
"We were following Artemis's trail," Grover said. "I was pretty sure it led here. Some powerful monster scent. She must have stopped here looking for the mystery monster. But we haven't found anything yet."
"Zoe?"
Bianca said nervously.
"If it is the General?"
"It cannot be," Zoe snapped. "Percy must have seen an iris message or some other illusion."
"Illusions don't crack marble floors," I told her. Zoe took a deep breath, trying to calm herself. I didn't know why she was taking it so personally, or how she knew this General guy, but I figured now wasn't the time to ask.
"If Percy is telling the truth about the skeleton warriors," she said, "we have no time to argue. They are the worst, the most horrible. We must leave now."
"Good idea," I said.
"I was not including thee, boy," Zoe said. "You are not part of this quest."
"Hey, I'm trying to save your lives."
"You shouldn't have come, Percy," Thalia said grimly. "But you're here now. Come on, let's get back to the van."
"That is not thy decision," Zoe snapped.
Thalia scowled at her.
"You're not the boss here, Zoe. I don't care how old you are. You're still a conceited little brat."
"You never had any wisdom when it came to boys," Zoe growled. "You never could leave them behind."
Thalia looked like she was about to hit Zoe. Then everyone froze. I heard a growl so loud I thought one of the rocket engines was starting up. Below us, a few adults screamed. A little kid's voice screeched with delight.
"Kitty!"
Something enormous bounded up the ramp. It was the size of a pickup truck, with silver claws and golden glittering fur. I'd seen this monster once before. 2 years ago, I'd glimpsed it briefly from a train. Now, up close and personal, it looked even bigger.
"The Nemean lion," Thalia said.
"Don't move."
The lion roared so loud it parted my hair. Its fangs gleamed like stainless steel.
"Separate on my mark," Zoe said. "Try to keep it distracted."
"Until when?" Grover asked.
"Until I think of a way to kill it. Go."
I uncapped Riptide and rolled to the left. Arrows whistled past me, and Grover played a sharp tweet-tweet cadence on his reed pipes. I turned and saw Zoe and Bianca climbing the Apollo capsule. They were firing arrows, one after another, all shattering harmlessly against the lion's metallic fur. The lion swiped the capsule and tipped it on its side, spilling the hunters off the back. Grover played a frantic, horrible tune, and the lion turned toward him, but Thalia stepped into its path, holding up Aegis, and the lion recoiled.
"Roar!"
Hi-ya! Thalia said. Back!